This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Pottery is one of the signature forms of art in the Tar Heel State. The craft dates back to the early settlers, and current works are influenced by their traditional methods and techniques. But the potter's styles are only part of what makes North Carolina pottery exceptional. From the mountains to the coast, the unique clays of the Carolinas give artists the creative material to create special work. A new exhibition at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences looks at the science behind the materials potters use. Dig It, The Secrets of Soil, features work by Seagrove potter Ben Owen III, and he joins me today. Welcome, Ben. Good to have you here.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us here today.
Good to have you. Also with me, Mark Hewitt. He is the president of the North Carolina Pottery Center in Seagrove. Welcome, Mark. Good to have you.
Nice to see be here, Frank.
And with us as well is Steve Blankenbaker. He is a ceramics engineer and geologist with Taylor Clay Products in Salisbury. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. Ben, tell us about your role now and a little bit about this new exhibit.
Well, the museum first approached me to think about some ways of creating kind of an educational component as well as a exhibition of my work to coincide with learning a little bit about some of our local materials, specifically more of the clays and then, of course, how we create some of the colors that we apply to the surfaces.
And therein lies a story in many stories, Mark. It's got pottery has a rich history in this state. Give us a kind of a brief overview.
Well, it started with Moravians who made beautiful earthenware out near Winston-Salem, and then stoneware clays became available, and the technology of firing pots at a higher temperature in so-called groundhog kilns that are dug in the ground, wood-fired, became the most common techniques for making utilitarian ware. And that tradition lasted up until the 1920s. And then an artware period began with Jugtown pottery. And the traditional folk pottery style has continued from the early 19th century all the way up till today. And some of the potters like Ben, like myself, like the potters at Jugtown are making work that echoes the styles of the older wares.
In that utilitarian pottery you talked about, I mean, it was an industry. This was an important, you know, there was a time when that's what people used, and so it was an important industry, right?
Yeah, all the farmers, all the households needed pots for preserving food, for, and even making illicit whiskey.
What about indigenous populations now? Is there much of a history of pottery use?
I mean, we all think of the Southwest as being the epicenter of Native American pottery, but in fact, there were beautiful pots made in the Southeast, in North Carolina also.
And, Steve, this is interesting, and I didn't know about this. Wedgwood china has an interesting place in North Carolina's pottery history, right?
Yes. In the 1800s, Wedgwood sent some people out to try to find kaolin, very high-quality porcelain-type clays in the mountains of North Carolina. And they successfully found some materials on Cherokee native land and carried several tons back to England. It was very good for what they were trying to do, but they were unable to get that on a regular basis very easily, so they never pursued it beyond initially what they received. But that's a typical North Carolina mountain kaolin.
Ben, your family has a personal history with pottery, right? Tell us that. Tell us about it.
Well, starting out early in my life, my grandfather and my grandparents and parents and many family members as well had lots of pottery on all the shelves, the bookcases. So most of the time our bookcases displayed work from not only our family but also other families in the region that made pottery. But going back to the late 1700s, early 1800s, just the as Mark had really showed, as far as the type of work that they were making back then, out of necessity, you know, making the pots every day. But then the transformation, I think, was really the critical part and probably the essential part in survival for our family, as well as other families in the area, when really the demand for those types of pieces were not available or in need compared to glass and metal containers or other mass-produced type ceramic, I guess, vessels. So from there, they really started to have the opportunity through the Busbys that created Jugtown pottery and then other influences from arts and crafts, as well as other components that brought more colorful designs, more ornate features to the work. as well as being rooted in some of those early traditional and utilitarian forms. So I believe that, you know, growing up and looking at the past and then what we're doing today and how we're inspiring people for the future, I think there's a lot of great possibilities.
Mark, I tend to think of clay as clay because I'm not a potter. And as a gardener, I actually have epithets and sometimes modifiers that I use in front of the word clay. But is it all the same? What is there something unique about North Carolina clay, or are there unique features that that potters really come to love about this stuff?
Certainly. I mean, I came here for the clay. I did quite an extensive geological search of different states and wanted to come to a place where there was good local clay, good wood to fire my kiln, and pottery tradition, which suggested that there was a market. So some potters are very keenly aware of the terroir of the work that they make, that like a wine, it reflects a particular region. Well, the clay reflects its region by its appearance after firing. And so there are some distinctive traditions in North Carolina. You've got a gray salt glaze that's common in the eastern Piedmont around Seagrove. And then you've got a dark ash-glazed green that comes from the Catawba Valley south of Hickory. And so when I go out and look for clays, I'll take something out of the ground and actually eat it. And you rub it against your teeth, and you can tell how much sand is in the clay. And it indicates how fine the particle sizes are. And thanks to Steve and the work that he's been doing over with Taylor Clay, many of the clays that they have been able to find for their large-scale brick manufacturing have been offered to us potters to experiment with.
So in some ways, it's the clay that potters now use is a byproduct of what you're looking for. You make bricks.
Yeah, we make brick that are all different colors, and the colors go all the way through the body. So we're always looking for clays that burn different colors. And the more plastic or the more sticky the clay is, the better. And we're always looking for those type of clays, and those happen to be the clays that are in most desirable for the pottery.
And clay that goes all the way through the brick, that's an interesting distinction. You may not know this, but a lot of brick has just got a kind of a veneer or something sort of...
Yes, we would make what would be termed architectural brick, which means the color goes all the way through the brick.
So now the big question is, what is clay?
The clays in North Carolina would be varied, but the clay minerals themselves are hydrous alumina silicates. Hydrous meaning there's a water molecule attached. It's got aluminum. It's got silicon. And the unique thing about a clay mineral is the molecular structure is platy. So it has it's like a clay mineral stack up like a deck of cards, and that's a unique mineral structure. That mineral structure is what lets clay be slick and what makes it plastic and what makes it work for pottery. It's a very high surface area to mass ratio.
And I was interested to find out, it never occurred to me before, that all clay comes from igneous rock. I thought maybe it's just a blend of whatever happened to be there and then some other conditions, but it's basically igneous rock.
The original rock would be a granite, and in that granite would be some feldspar, and the feldspar weathers and weathers into kaolin clay or a similar type clay, and that process is called kaolinization. And then as that rock weathers, it decomposes and washes and basically disperses it across the state through streams and waterways mostly.
So that would mean regionally things would change from place to place across the state of North Carolina, right? The clays are different.
Very much so, and that's why we look for clays in different regions. We have several mines across the state, and it's almost like what Mark was saying about some pottery in some areas fires different than clays in another region, and that's based on the type of materials that were present locally.
So, Ben, what are you looking for in clays? I guess as you go from project to project, tell us what makes a good clay for you.
Well, as Steve discussed, where the plasticity of the clay is, of course, an integral part in making a successful pot on the wheel, but the color equally is important, especially for, you know, how the finished product looks. Lots of things that we do and make have a glaze or a glass type finish on the surface, whether it's been colorized or revealing the color, natural color and qualities of the clay. So the temperature can also play a key role. Some clays, if we take like some of the earthen clays, some of the red clays, and we take it up to up to in excess of 2300 degrees Fahrenheit, it will actually become like a glass itself and start deforming in those beautiful pots that we make and be a disaster. So, but on the other side of it, you can find ways to work in different varying temperatures. But when I look at the clays and how it responds, the weight and the distribution, when I make a piece on the wheel, I want the form to feel really good in your hands. It doesn't feel like it's heavy in your hands, or especially a functional piece that someone's going to fill it up with tea or coffee or drink from, that you want it to be comfortable in their hands by the time they feel it. So the structure of the piece is important, as well as how we treat the surface of the piece and how the end product shows up. So I think those are still, even today for me, being a challenge.
Well, you brought some samples in with you, and I'll kind of hold them up. I have this kind of mauve, brownish, grayish piece of clay that looks the color of clay. What the first thing that comes to mind when you say clay, it's kind of this, and it pulls apart pretty easily. It's not very elastic. Can you tell me what this is and how you might use it?
Well, that's one of our clays that is already blended and prepared and ready to be wedged and placed on the wheel. Whereas other pieces that I brought along were like a reddish type clay, and then that's other properties of materials I spoke of earlier that have a little more iron content to it. Mm-hmm. And others are more almost like a cream color or off-white finish. But with the gray type clay that's really malleable at this point, I brought that to kind of show some of the clay that we actually harvest from our own property. And historically, it was one of the old clay pits in the Seagrove area. And through the years, we've just had the permission to go in and dig some of the clay and take it back and use it as our needs were. But the land came for sale not too long ago, and we just felt like preserving that and being able to continue finding that clay on that property would be such an integral part. And a lot of ways, like when we make something, we want to say we picked up the apples to make the fresh homemade apple pie. Well, we're making the pots from clay that's here nearby.
So pot local is kind of part of the thing. And when you're looking for that, Steve, I guess Mark, processing is an important part of this. You don't just kind of dig it out of the side of the stream bed and start making a pot.
Yeah, there are various different ways. You can pulverize the clay, liquefy it, and then dry it so it's nice and smooth and run it through a pug mill. But the thing that's important about North Carolina is that what Ben has inherited and what we're all part of now is this great world-class tradition that is really Southern. It's just as music from the South is well known. Well, back in the 19th century, when there was the same cross-pollination of cultures of Anglo, Scots, Irish settlers and African Americans getting to be part of this region, they created musical forms that are echoed in decorative arts forms. And so you can think of textiles, furniture, pottery making as being very distinctive. And truly, for me, coming over from England with my prior training, to find an extant pottery tradition of that power was quite staggering. And it's really it's a tribute to the potters that have gone before, whether it's from Ben's family or from families over in the Catawba Valley, that it survived to this day. And the tradition keeps morphing. And you know, the New South is represented in the pottery tradition today. You've got places like Penland that are epicenters of creativity. You've got potters down in Wilmington making fantastic pots, and we come from all over the world now.
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about the material and the native materials here, but what about the artifacts themselves? You talked about that tradition. If I look at the pots, if I look at the vessels or the actual products, is there a Southern characteristic in North Carolina, something that sort of jumps out at you?
In some ways, it's less regional than it used to be. There used to be an identifiable style, whether it was wares made at Jugtown and the so-called artware period starting in about the 1920s. And then prior to that, there was this utilitarian tradition that was very much part of the earth. The clay was dug. It was refined very simply into clay bodies that were made into utilitarian pots. And you can see the lack of refinement of the process, but it's magnificent. And there's a certain ceramic sensibility, which actually goes back to the tea ceremony in Japan, where the first thing you do when you pick up a pot is turn it over and you look and see what the clay body is like. And you can see how grainy it is, how fine it is, what the color is. You don't looking at it to see who made it. You
doesn't, know, that, but, doesn't that, you, don't you end up with a lot of tea in your lap if you
happens all the time.
It seems kind of sad. But I take your point. So this is a very important part of it. And then the process itself in terms of techniques, Ben, how much of those are sort of traditional? I mean, do they change much or is making a pot or a vessel pretty much been the same for centuries?
Well, the actual technique of making pottery has evolved over thousands of years from, I guess, coil building or hand building and then eventually using a potter's wheel, whether it was manually controlled or, as today, we can use electric-powered wheels. But I believe that you know, what we have in the Seagrove area is a good, strong foundation for making distinctive forms that were influenced from European ancestry, other areas, maybe in Middle Eastern-type influences that came into play over time. But then the Asian culture, being such a rich history there, especially, as Mark noted, some of the types of wares that they made and how they were used. And some of those have been adopted by our community and potters all over because it gives a sense of the value of the work and knowing the maker and knowing the materials. And I think when you can, you know the baker and you know they made the apple pie as I mentioned earlier, then you understand what makes them tick. And it's the same way with potters, what makes their style unique compared to another potter. And I think that's what's really wonderful is having that chance to meet people that make and create these earthen vessels.
You brought a few pieces with you. Maybe I can get you to pick one up and describe it for me and talk about some of the unique features. Yeah, that one there is.
Well, some of these are based on early, as Mark noted, some of the ash glazes and other techniques that are a combination of ash and salt glazing. And salt glazing technique first developed, we believe, from the 14th century from more German influences and came over with early settlement and found the clays that would work well for that. And some people say, well, why did they put sugar? Why didn't they put pepper in the kiln? Why had they determined that salt worked for glazing? And so in short, we believe that they probably were burning wood from barrels that fish were brought in at port and had the salt brine in it and eventually linked it to that.
See, that's the importance of failure. We don't talk about the number of times where your pot fell apart because you used pepper or you used something else, and you end up with the thing that won. This has a unique color, too. Is that in the clay itself?
This one?
That one, yeah.
Well, some of the newer things that has been a great challenge for me is working with all different types of coloring pigments and oxides and layering them on the surface of a pot. So by adding elements of iron mixed in a right combination and then cobalt as well as copper and other types of finishes, and that one particular piece is basically iron and cobalt, but creating a catalyst in the glaze. And I think that's what's so exciting is finding materials like titanium dioxide or magnesium carbonate or other elements that could be found in materials that you can blend into the recipe, apply it to the earthen vessel, and then from there be able to create these unique textures.
Well, let me talk about it a little bit. It's a vase, and it is kind of a reddish, copperish, essentially, the main part of it. But then it is speckled with this amoeba-like cobalt flecks and specks that are, as I say, sort of amoeba-like in their form. Do you press those in there, or does that just happen? You know, I mean, how do you get the speckled effect?
Well, actually, when we put the glaze on, I put it on in layers up to four coats of glaze on the surface of that piece. So I'm actually spraying it on and building it up in layers. But it looks like a white glaze when I put it in the kiln with the raw ingredients. But when it comes out, all those key ingredients work together. But it has a lot to do with how you heat the kiln, how you hold it, how you cool it. So very much like baking, some precision has to go on in the process. Otherwise, if you overheat it or underfire it, as we call it, sometimes the colors won't develop at the right time.
All very fascinating stuff. Wish we had more time, but I want to thank you, Ben Owen III, a Seagrove potter. He gives a demonstration at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences on Friday, May 15th, part of Dig It, the Secrets of Soil exhibition. All the details are on our website. Steve Blankenbaker is a ceramics engineer with Taylor Clay Products in Salisbury, and Mark Hewitt is a potter and president of the North Carolina Pottery Center at Seagrove. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, listen to your mother. You heard it here on The State of Things. Stay tuned.